Hey, we're back with another edition of High Fidelity. Spring is here, and not to brag, but around these parts, the smell of flowers is in the air, and everything seems to be buzzing with life. Times like these, it's hard not to have plants on the brain, and we fully endorse you getting out there to meet your green neighbors. While you do that, we thought you'd like to hear from two of our favorite plant people, Chelsea Armstrong and Lee Joseph. You might remember Chelsea from our season 4 classic, Forest Garden, where we explored the roots of permaculture through the lens of indigenous food systems, which have been overlooked all too often. Today, Chelsea is sitting down with Lee Joseph, the Squamish ethnobotanist known widely for her culturally informed field guide, Held by the Land. They both do incredible work in academia and in community. Their conversation today will take us into some of the thornier parts of the field. Let's go.
Should we just introduce ourselves? You guys can choose whether or not you want to use it, but sometimes it's nicer if, when we introduce ourselves, we get pronunciations right and labs right and all that stuff.
That would be great.
Okay. Go ahead, Lee.
Okay. Lee Joseph, Queensna, Stiwit, Kwashaman, Skopmish, Estatmis, Ochlameo, Anwanoxtan, Squalowin, Ayokhtan, Sequoital. So my English name is Lee Joseph, and my ancestral name is Stiwit, and I come from Estatmis Village in Skopmish territory, so in what's now known as Squamish, British Columbia. And I'm really happy to be here today with you. I am an assistant professor in the geography department at Simon Fraser University and an ethnobotanist for my community and alongside my community in Squamish. I'm a mother of two kids, Ava and Jake, and really just continuing my own learning and reconnecting to plant knowledge through these different avenues of work. I'm also an entrepreneur, so I have a business called Squalum Botanicals, which is really my kind of creative outlet for the work that I do with plants.
Amazing. Okay. Hi, I'm Chelsea Geralda Armstrong. I am a settler scholar based mostly up in northern BC in Tsimshian and Gitxsan country, but I'm also an assistant professor at SFU in Indigenous Studies, and I am an associate member of the School of Resource and Environmental Management. And I'm director of the Historical Ecological Research Lab at SFU, and we get up to all sorts of research kind of at the intersection of archaeology, historical ecology, and ethnobotany. Okay, those are our intros. And then I guess we'll just jump in. I'm going to start with maybe an obvious question. And it's one I get from folks a lot, you know, if I'm meeting them for the first time and they ask, oh, what do you do? And I say ethnobotany. They're often stumped, right? Like, what's that? What does it mean to be an ethnobotanist? And so that's my first question for you. What is ethnobotany? And I want you to answer it as broadly as possible, and then maybe tell us what an ethnobotanist does.
Yeah, thank you for that question. The first thing that comes to mind for me is like when I first realized that ethnobotany was a field of study. It was many years ago now, and I went to a free talk that Dr. Nancy Turner was giving at the Vancouver Public Library, and I was listening to her sharing about the community-based work she was doing within the field of ethnobotany. And for me, I was at a time in my life where I had spent some years training in outdoor guiding, actually. So doing a lot of rock climbing and mountaineering and sea kayak guiding. And I was at a point sort of in that career where I was like, I think I want to change gears a little bit. I had quite a few friends getting injured and in accidents. And I just sort of felt like for myself, I wanted to shift gears. And so I was looking at going back to school. And when I went to this talk, it really landed for me. I think largely because as a person, so I come from mixed ancestry. My dad is Coast Salish from Squamish, and his mom's family is from Stenamith or Nanaimo on Vancouver Island. And my mom is of English and Sephardic Jewish ancestry. And we grew up in what's now known as Victoria, British Columbia, in Lekwungen and Wasanich territories. And I have spent a lot of my life when it comes to identity thinking about belonging, thinking about where I've felt in my life the most held and safe. And my parents, when I was growing up, would take me to a lot of elders' homes, and we would sit, I would sit in particularly, just sit on the couch and listen and, you know, just be in those environments. And I just remember them being so, so warm, so calming, so nourishing. And those memories have kind of carried me through my life in a lot of ways. And those experiences were really central, more so than I realized even as a kid going through them. And when I was listening to Nancy's talk and she was, you know, sharing these images and stories of working with elders, I sort of felt this like, oh my gosh, this is what I need to do. This is a path, you know, towards some of these identity questions. And I realized later that, you know, my outdoor guiding work was really about spending time on the land and those moments that I still think back to of, like, you know, being in the mountains, like under a starry sky, or, you know, pushing myself and experiencing natural environments like that. And so, like, a definition that I often use for ethnobotany is the study of the cultural interrelationships between people and plants. And the land is so central and foundational, you know, to this area of knowledge. That was many years ago when I realized this was an area of study. I was so excited. It connected so many dots for me. And I've learned so much, you know, as I set out on that path. I introduced myself to Nancy after that talk and, you know, just said, like, I'm really interested in this field. And being a very gracious and loving person, she just said, please reach out to me, you know, when you're at the point where you would like to start these studies. And so I'm answering this very broadly, by the way, but, and so in order to get, you know, on that path, because ethnobotany as a field of study is very interdisciplinary, I really wanted to have a grounding in Western science to understand at least a little bit about, you know, plant ecology, plant biochemistry. And so I basically, after that talk, went back and upgraded all of my sciences and math so that I could take a science route to this work, which I'm glad I did. There was a lot of learning, you know, on that path. And as I've developed my kind of like critical awareness around, you know, this field, I'm really glad to have taken that path and be able to include my experience as being a science student in faculties and departments that really had zero Indigenous representation in them. So I found that once I did do that science degree and then I applied for a master's with Nancy, that master's was really my first time coming back to Squamish as an adult and doing research and work as a community member who's like reconnecting, but also as like a master's student. So really kind of, you know, new to research. And that experience was really one where I felt so strongly that I was on the right path, because when I came home, there were family members who continue to walk alongside me as mentors and guides for how to carry out research within community, but also have helped me understand, you know, from a cultural standpoint, that this field of ethnobotany as it stands is really, you know, when we think about Indigenous cultural context, is a part of knowledge systems and identity and ways of connecting to, you know, ancestral lands and waters that has existed for thousands of years. So I feel like it's been a really amazing container and path to be walking that's both academic, but it's also very much community guided, which is really important to me. So yeah, kind of going back to that definition, this study of culture and interrelationships, you know, between plants really points more to the relational ways of being in the world with more than human life, including plants, as opposed to maybe some of the underpinnings of the academic study, which really does have roots in extractive, you know, very colonial approaches to looking at indigenous plant knowledge.
Yeah, and that's a really broad but place-based kind of definition. And I think that's one of the most important aspects of ethnobotany, is that it's not something that's, you know, super scalable from one region to the other, because it is so place-based. It is so context-specific. You know, I have a lot of students that will take courses with me, and they, you know, think that they're going to learn about just all the kind of universal uses of plants, right? What we would refer to as herbalism or something, you know, in that related field. And so ethnobotanists like to keep that distinction clear. And I think you touched on this, that might be part of the academic hangup, but how would you define ethnobotany as kind of separate from herbalism or from the kind of literature on social ecological systems and some of that work? And why would that distinction matter?
Yeah. During my doctoral defense, actually, the external examiner asked me about the term ethnobotany and how I felt about that as like an indigenous botanist. And why isn't it just indigenous botany? Why is it ethnobotany? And sort of, you know, I think there's lots of conversation around the terminology and what that can carry with it in terms of potentially othering or putting certain knowledge systems above that kind of thing. Often in my community, people from the community will reach out to me and ask about basically prescribing plants for different uses. And I understand that, because our medicine people were practitioners that bridged knowledge and spirit and observation and medicine, and, you know, offering and sharing that in a way that was very healing. Ethnobotany itself, you know, differs from herbalism in that generally, as a field of study, the goal and the way that we're educated does not give us the skills to prescribe or to even suggest, you know, certain medicines. And I think it gets even more, like, as an indigenous ethnobotanist, I can understand like why my community would think it's one and the same, because culturally, you know, our medicine, plant medicine people did it all.
As it is, yeah.
But then from, you know, kind of a like Western herbalist approach, like generally one would go to a herbalist to seek out certain plant medicines to take for a particular ailment. And so although there's overlap in that, you know, within ethnobotany, of course, you are dealing with culturally sensitive information, you know, ancestral knowledge and recipes and harvesting areas. But the goal is not to, you know, take that and to then prescribe to people for health reasons. But I think from a cultural standpoint, those lines are less defined. I think on the academic side, like certainly there's reasons that people aren't stepping into that role of being a medicine person.
Totally.
So yeah, anyways, I think those are some distinctions, but also some interesting overlap.
And it is interesting too, because when you talk about community-based work, you know, if I'm out in the field and, you know, we're all about future-proofing a lot of our work. So there's always youth coming out with us that are taking part in the research or just going on plant walks. And, you know, what's the first question they're going to ask about plants? It's how do you use them, right? Yeah. Like it does, there is that intersection very clearly. And so whether or not folks are publishing on that, we can talk a bit about the ethics a bit. But I want to kind of take it back, and we touched on this a little bit, but if folks listening right now have taken an ethnobotany course, or if they're lucky enough to have gotten some exposure to the field in some kind of other context, we typically talk about two origin stories to the field of ethnobotany, right? The first ethnobotany is one of the oldest sciences on Earth. So, you know, before people started observing complex pollination patterns or photosynthesis, we first, as a species, had to know which plants feed us, which ones would kill us, which ones would heal us. And so that's one origin story for ethnobotany. And I just want to know how you identify with this, and how do you think that definition of ethnobotany can challenge the way we define science and who we consider to be scientists.
Mm. Yeah, a couple of things come up for me. One is that from, you know, the cultural mentorship and guidance that I've received, there are such deep teachings around how it is that we learn from plants. And I guess taking a step back, like in Squamish cultural belief, plants are relatives. So they are beings with autonomy, you know, with rights, and that it's really on us to build relationships that are based in respect, reciprocity, and responsibility. So from that level of really reframing plants away from, you know, being resources or sort of simply being there for human use, when we think about them as being relatives and we kind of think about, okay, well, where's our responsibility for building those relationships? How do we do that? Part of that is how you receive teachings from plants. And from a cultural standpoint, there's some ways that that can happen through dreams or through a very different kind of listening and presence on the land that is very much in, you know, conflict with the ways that we would think about learning from plants academically. So I always come back to that, that more kind of felt sense, that relational responsibility and like that really makes a lot of sense to me in terms of how, you know, how to work with plants. Another is I remember taking a like zoopharmacognosy class and learning, you know, how early people learn so much from animals, yeah. You know, and watching patterns of how animals are using plants. And so it just kind of expands the, I guess, a bit of the origin stories of where these knowledges come from and how deeply rooted they are. They don't stand alone. They're not siloed. You know, they're very interconnected. And so when we think about, you know, the field of ethnobotany, there's just a lot of questions, you know, as I've pursued this path, both in academia and, you know, cultural and community sense, there's kind of more questions than answers that I find I kind of come up against in terms of it's a beautiful thing to look at our origins and every person, people, you know, group on earth has ethnobotanical histories and has those, you know, connections. It's also a field and an area of knowledge that is rife with ethical concerns and intellectual property concerns and extractive potential that really needs to be taken seriously. So how that informs the field today is really that, to me, one of the biggest missteps can be trying to be the expert, you know, in a field that is grounded in cultural history and ancestry.
Yeah, this is it, right? And we have these questions all the time around, you know, well, who is an ethnobotanist or who can do it? But that gets into the second origin, right? When I call these origin stories, it's kind of just how they're taught or how we've come to understand the development of method and theory and these sorts of things in the Western context. And this second origin of ethnobotany is a little more nefarious, right? It developed hand in hand with early European colonialism, right? You have very influential botanists like Joseph Banks at the Royal Gardens at Kew. And because of him and his benefactors, you know, by the late 1700s, there was a botanist on every major naval expedition, whether that was Cook or Quadra. These Navy officers and explorers were sailing around the Pacific, often making, quote, first contact with large indigenous polities and societies. And so you have botanists on these ships, people like Manzino and George Wilhelm Steller, who folks in BC will know is, you know, the Steller's Jay is named after him, Steller Sea Lion. And then, of course, Archibald Menzies, who was on Vancouver's expedition, circumnavigating the island. And of course, Menzies' name is littered across Latin binomials for countless plants in the Pacific Northwest. But the point is that botanists like Menzies were tasked with, quote, discovering, recording, and collecting new plants in service to the colonial homeland. And they were, you know, for the most part, pretty well-trained botanists. But when you read some of their diaries, I mean, Menzies is just fumbling through the flora of the country and relying almost entirely on local indigenous communities and indigenous botanists. You know, what do they call plants? What are they using those plants for? How are they managed? you know, of course, Menzies sends this back to banks and those at Q, and then there's all sorts of products that get developed out of this, or all sorts of cachet that these explorers get from discovering these plants, right? Sounds like it could be out of a conference today, right? Where people are kind of carrying a lot of the credit for work that's been done in community. And so this foray into, you know, indigenous ideas and botanical epistemologies are the colonial foundations upon which ethnobotany and frankly a lot of other mainstream Western sciences developed. The second origin story of ethnobotany is that it was evolved and defined directly out of the colonial project. And so do you think ethnobotanists, and this, you know, you can keep it to Canada or go global, but do you think practitioners reckon enough with these colonial foundations, especially in terms of how the discipline is taught?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a question that's been at the top of my mind, you know, from the beginning, from the outset, but more when I started to develop my own critical awareness. And I remember I was at a conference about, gosh, my daughter was really little. So yeah, about a decade ago. And there were people in the room that I had read papers from, and when I was starting out in this field, just really impacted, you know, my learning experience. I remember during that time of studying, you know, I was working with Fritillaria campsichensis, in particular, Atlasum in Squamish, so Northern Rice Root. And in order to dig into historical record on that species, I needed to go through a lot of old ethnographies and read a lot of very colonial perspectives that contained a lot of anti-Indigenous racism and a lot of narratives that were very uncomfortable for me, yet there's this treasure of information, you know, and so it's a really interesting kind of process. And then at this conference, I remember people were just so celebratory about how this field was addressing the urgency of recording this knowledge before elders, you know, pass. And there was just this like really kind of like, it was really like a self-congratulatory feeling. And I just felt this in the pit of my stomach. I felt so uncomfortable. And I was like, what is this? What is coming up for me right now? I, you know, stood to speak, and I cry in public all the time. It's not my favorite quality about myself. But, you know, I stood up and I realized that my discomfort was in the fact that we weren't talking at all about the colonial impacts on this area of knowledge and access. Yeah. There was no conversation about the critical awareness of, you know, the impact of ongoing colonization and colonialism within Canada, and the very real health impacts, the very real, you know, impacts of residential school, the 60s scoop, the endless, you know, barriers put in place for people to access the land and water bases to build these relationships. And then the marginalization, you know, the ongoing marginalization and sort of victim blaming, you know, that happens. Yeah. And there also was not very many Indigenous people in the room. And so the discomfort, and I stood and spoke about it, and I did, you know, I was emotional, but I said, this is very uncomfortable for me that, you know, on one hand, we have this area of knowledge and study that is so close to my heart and has given me a path into community, into this line of inquiry and learning in life. But I'm also very aware of the complete lack of, you know, acknowledging everything that has impacted the people who have stewarded these relationships. So there's it's much more palatable, you know, from an academic standpoint, to take the knowledge as separate from all of that, from the people, from the lived experience, from the responsibility that we all carry as Canadians in this shared colonial history.
And it's funny because you're kind of the, as I'm listening to you speak, I'm thinking, oh my God, it's the same thing that was happening 100 years ago. You know, you had the anthropologists, like you talked about, these early ethnographers like Philip Drucker and Boas and Jeunesse, and they're going around recording this information that now, as you say, there's that okay, well, they were kind of doing some weird stuff on the side, but then, oh, then we have this, these records that are really, you know, important for a lot of folks, for a lot of communities, particularly as we go into, you know, rights and title and legal claimants mm-hmm. that are having issues yeah. with that. But those guys were all writing at this kind of salvage anthropology thing, right? Like, okay, we got to record this stuff before it disappears. Yeah. The ethnobotanists you're talking about are saying the same things, but what's missing, this was Vine Deloria's critique of anthropology writ large, was this idea of disappearance was itself a colonial construct that does not account for notions of certainly cultural change and adaptation, but more importantly, ongoing political resistance to that knowledge and information disappearing. If we're going to be talking about disappearance, we have to ask why, right? And I think sometimes that gets, you know, you get a one-liner maybe in an introduction on residential schools, and then it kind of goes into the more, as you say, palatable things. I have this conversation a lot with some friends and colleagues in the field that are maybe a little more open to critique, but this idea of bioprospecting, right? There's a whole host of academic and scholarly societies for ethnobotanists. You know, we've been to some of these conferences. And one thing that strikes me is that there's still a massive gap in what researchers and community members deem to be appropriate in ethnobotany. And some of what I read of ethnobotany, say in the, you know, 70s and 80s, but more so today, is what I would call bioprospecting and almost a little close to biopiracy. Do you want to talk a bit about, I mean, we can even start with just defining what those terms are.
These practices of bioprospecting and biopiracy, I think it's intertwined with the lack of really robust ways to protect intellectual property within an Indigenous context, very systemic in terms of the extractive approach to plant medicines and foods and superfoods, and essentially, like it sounds, like prospecting for knowledge versus minerals. Like, we're really looking at kind of the origins of how John Harshberger defined ethnobotany. It was really about, like, okay, how can we go into these communities that we already feel we're above and we're smarter than and we're better than, but they have this information that we want, and we want to take it out and we want to look at what economic value it has. We don't want to credit them with any of that because that's too complicated. So we're going to forget, you know, that they exist. We're going to take this, own it, and benefit from it. And so it's kind of going from that, like, prospecting, looking for information, and then taking it and actually benefiting from it without recognition or sharing those benefits at all with the people who have stewarded that knowledge. And that's really only possible when you've dehumanized people to a certain level where you really just don't believe that they have autonomy or deserve to be credited, you know, for this knowledge. And so, yeah, it's tricky. And the first question that communities ask me, because I've worked with other Indigenous communities outside of my home community, and the first question is, how are you going to protect this knowledge? How do we know that it's not going to become the next pharmaceutical and then we're not going to have access to it? And these are not easy questions to answer because there's no fail-safe way, but there are things we can do that are really reliant on the researcher doing that work. And if that researcher is not critically educated and does not understand, hasn't done the back work to educate themselves on colonial history and ongoing barriers within an Indigenous context, and they're doing work within Indigenous communities, or if they're really driven by really establishing kind of their individual claim to knowledge or their career, all of those are very dangerous pathways. And I think Indigenous communities are, they have been and continue to be, and grow awareness and, you know, tools within the community themselves to safeguard against this more and more, but it's very present. And I, you know, I've reviewed a couple of papers this year that I couldn't believe the lack of depth when it came to, like, this was apparently an Indigenous science collaboration, but beyond the abstract and the mention of the Indigenous community, there was nothing else in the body of the paper, no voice, Indigenous voice, perspective, anything. So it's very real, the, you know, the risks for people. And it's something that within this field, it really needs to be a foundational part of how people are trained and educated. And that's not just specific to Canada. You know, there are colonial histories across the globe. There are extractive practices happening. For me, the best way I've sort of tackled it is coming down to an individual level. How can I not only, you know, build trust with the community I'm working with, but do that work, that heavy lifting of figuring out how to safeguard the information that's being shared, but also how I listen to the community in terms of what can be shared outside of community and what can't. But we go back to kind of, you know, herbalism, and the public interest in plants is huge, mm-hmm. especially plants that are situated as having the incredible, beautiful benefits that we know plants carry with them. But when those fall into the, you know, wrong systems or hands or whatever, you can't protect from all of that. But in your individual practice, you can do the work to educate yourself so that you're not re-traumatizing, re-following those extractive practices. And then really thinking about, with knowledge dissemination, like, what are you allowed to share in publications? What are you allowed to share mm-hmm. at a conference? And where do your kind of priorities lie in terms of the community's guidance in that?
It's funny when you talk about, you know, reviewing some of these papers that are touted as kind of, you know, indigenous or local led or something. And then it's just very clear that, like, well, are they, or, you know, maybe they're not including that as part of the research process. They're just saying it. And there is a transparency that's often missing from these processes. And when, you know, I have students debate bioprospecting in an introductory course I teach, because exactly as you say, you know, students supporting the idea of bioprospecting will point to just how many plant-based medicines are currently on the market, saving people from, you know, extreme pain, chronic illness, and even death, right? But as you point out, it's, and other students on the other side of the debate will point to the exploitation economy, and not just in medicines, but cosmetics, superfoods, like you point out. And so despite best intentions, you know, whether it's the Nagoya Protocol or other, you know, UN CBD type agreements around free, prior, and informed consent or compensation models, it's hard to create a model that's scalable in a system that, by definition, in a global capitalist system, that can't be divorced from exploitation. And so it does come down, as you say, I agree, it comes down to the kind of the individual researcher. And so this is maybe a trick question, but, you know, the Society of Ethnobotany, they recently changed their name just a few years ago. It used to be called the Society of Economic Botany, and they thought, oh boy, yeah, we should maybe change that, right? And, you know, the meetings are really great. If you go to these conferences, there's a healthy dose of cool historical research or community-based research, but there's also a healthy dose of talks that are effectively the results of bioprospecting. And so if you're walking into a session called The New Drugs of the Amazon, what goes through your mind? And maybe more to, as a follow-up, if a graduate student was presenting, so someone with, you know, very relatively little power broking abilities, and they're just starting out, what would you tell them?
Mm-hmm. My first thought is, okay, the new flags it immediately. When we think about the, again, the generations upon generations of Indigenous peoples and communities who have stewarded relationally, you know, these plants, there is nothing discoverable or new when we send a scientist or someone into these places. So already it kind of flags that it is not a comfortable space to be in, that likely the way that this is being viewed is going to be extractive or not include any cultural context or responsibility. I think that for a student like that, or going through that, I would probably have questions, you know, first of when you think about, you know, the title of this talk, you know, the new medicines, have you come across the, you know, ancestral or cultural origins of these medicines? Have you learned where the knowledge of these like uses and applications came from. What stories are there? By just asking some of those questions of like, oh yeah, yeah, of course it came from the, you know, such and such people and they've used it for thousands of years. Okay, so you coming into this as somebody from outside of that community, drawing on ancestral knowledge, what parameters, like how do you define this as new, as cutting edge, as, you know, something that you have the right to share, you know, in this environment? And those questions really are about starting to, and I've tried to do this in some of my writing, is like really that self-reflective piece is often willfully not there, or people just haven't even thought of it because they haven't had to. If your lived reality is such that you never have to feel or experience the impacts of exploitation, extraction, marginalization, then it might just not even be in your view. So I think starting those conversations is really critical. And then, like you say, like it does come down to the individual. And I found that more often than not, you know, people who just have not thought about it before, because it's exciting, right? Oh, I'm going to go here. And I remember, yeah, like in sort of the early outset of reading around ethnobotany, a lot of it was white researchers going into ancestral communities. And it was this feeling of, you know, discovery, of being on the edge of adventure. And I think that's like
the Wade Davis and Plotkin and the Sean Connery like 80s movie Medicine Man. Like they're just the exotified other, right? Like let's go with our machetes into the jungle. And it's always a white woman or a white man, and with like this, you know, universalized indigenous community that usually doesn't have a name or context, and they all look a certain stereotypical way that is part of the white gaze on indigenous peoples. And it's across the board. It's like so part of the DNA of ethnobotany on the surface.
Yes.
You talked about Nancy Turner, and we both had the pleasure of, she was our supervisors for our research. And for those that don't know, I mean, in addition to being this just prolific and incredible scholar, you know, kindest woman, I think anyone who knows her just, that's the first thing. Oh my God, she's so nice. She takes so much time for her students. She writes them back. And I would say that Nancy comes, I don't want to ever be like an apologist for the field of ethnobotany or ethnobiology, but as a field with coherent method and theory and debates and critiques over like a century, there's been a lot of lessons on how to do this work and how not to. But in this new iteration of quote indigenous science, where we see the braiding, blending fad, you have a lot of folks that, you know, have spent their whole careers in like macroecology or population ecology or conservation biology, and they're going, yeah, let's just grab indigenous knowledge, great, let's do it, let's go to the jungle with our machetes and just do this work. It's really easy, anybody can do it, as we see in these papers that are just getting pumped out around indigenous knowledge and Western science. And I guess my question to you is, like, as someone with that dual intellectual lineage from Squamish elders and the way you grew up and the stories you grew up around, but as well as your lineage through, you know, Nancy and folks like that, this new braiding blending fad, should we just shut up and be grateful that it's happening? Or is there something from the last century of ethnobotany method and theory that should be considered in this new age of blending science?
Yeah, I think the answer to that really lies in the work people have done or haven't done. And if, for example, someone is, you know, well into a conservation career, or as you mentioned, any of these, you know, areas where indigenous knowledge clearly has so much impact and context and gifts to offer, yet the knowledge itself is being viewed as something that can be sort of parsed up and put into packets that fit within a current, you know, construct or formula, but separate from the entire, you know, cultural fabric, cultural, ecological, like spiritual, you know, fabric that these knowledges exist in, then it's essentially recreating, you know, these extractive origins. And it wouldn't feel that way for somebody. If somebody's opening up their view to think about, you know, including Indigenous knowledge, I bet that feels like a huge step. And it is. It is. Yet it's not doing anyone any favors. And if it's being utilized to amplify your own, you know, work and perspective without doing any of that critical self-reflection and understanding your positionality, understanding your blind spots and biases, and understanding how when you talk to somebody about their ancestral knowledge of whether it be plants or a particular place or a relationship with water, with fire, you know, that conversation is one, it's not disconnected from the entirety of that person's context, their community's context, both, you know, culturally and spiritually, but also like through a colonial lens, like the impacts that have taken place, the grief that still exists, the healing that's taking place. And so you can really easily re-traumatize somebody by having a bad experience. You know, people are so generous in my community. I see it, like people are so generous. And it's not that people are naive and will just go, you know, forth and share information without thinking about it. It's that if somebody shows up in a really good way, like both sides kind of see this shared goal of loving this earth, of wanting to contribute in some way and finding ways to, you know, communicate about that and finding those similarities and powerful ways, you know, to work together. That's not something people are opposed to, but it can be done well, and it's a lot harder to do it well. And then it can be done quickly and poorly. And when it's done quickly and poorly, it's very surface level, it's very tokenizing, and it's damaging. And so it really is in how it is carried out. So it can be, especially if it's Indigenous led, especially if there are clearly people coming together who have done that work to show up in a way that's informed and aware and critical. You know, I think there's a lot there that can work together. I think often too, like there's a problem with this sort of integration, and Leanne Simpson has written about this, you know, how the inherent, you know, issue with when traditionally ecological knowledge was turned into an acronym and sort of showed up everywhere, that people weren't then tasked with really doing any work to then claim the benefit of, you know, being inclusive, of considering, you know, Indigenous knowledge. And still within that framework, Indigenous knowledge is often underneath science or considered as lesser than. And so when we think about, you know, science, when we think about the depth of knowledge that comes from generational observation, sharing, learning, building deep relationships with at a species level, you know, and with local ecologies, like there's nothing more scientific than that. Yet within Western science, it's not included. So I think there's examples where that's changing, but generally speaking, and from my experience of going through a science degree, it's very much not part of that, you know, kind of picture and story. And so it's a really interesting place to look at how do you in meaningful ways kind of do that, you know, and I mean, Robin Wall Kimmerer in Braiding Sweetgrass, I mean, that's one of the, you know, most incredible analogies of braiding story, of personal experience, of critical awareness, of plants. So I think there are models that support that. But I also think there's a lot of potential pitfalls if it's not done well. And it's hard for people to face those kinds of things if they don't have to.
Yeah. And it comes down again to the kind of diversity of places and people, you know, in like Gitxsan context, if you want to know about the use of a plant, you better know who's governing that plant, who owns that plant. And that comes down to the governance structures and the social institutions. And then that comes down to land. Whose lakyapa are you on? And the work that's being done better be towards material changes to the house groups, to the Simgiget and Sigidam Hanach, like, where is this going to help with land use and language? It always comes down to those things, right?
Exactly.
And it's different for every community. Okay, so we talked a bit about the development of ethnobotany as a discipline in, you know, Western context, but also how ethnobotany exists through space and time for all societies in some form or another. And we can call it ethnobotany, we can call it indigenous science, we can call it Majagali, like, wherever it is, it's developed in situ over typically millennia, right? So there's these two views of it. How do you see the field of ethnobotany, say, you know, 40 years from now? Are those two things going to converge more? Is there going to be more branching? What would you like to see, maybe? Instead of being the predictive question, it can be the aspirational question.
Yeah, my first kind of image that comes to mind is really around what Indigenous communities are leading and building and healing towards. And I think we've mentioned the importance of youth being involved, having a front row seat and an active role in any time, essentially, as a researcher, if you're doing land-based research within the field of ethnobotany or anything else that's related to culture and land and governance and law, it's really your responsibility to ensure that you're opening up those opportunities to youth and community members to access these places on the land that, for a variety of reasons, they may not have been able to access. If you have those resources, that's a really great reciprocal way to involve youth. And so I think that's a really big piece. And my late uncle Chum, who's one of my teachers with plants in Squamish, he really emphasized that, you know, make sure the youth are there, make sure that they have access to this knowledge, because traditionally, you know, this knowledge was held by very specific families or people in community. And with everything that, you know, land-based knowledge and access has endured through colonization, it's now at a point where he was saying it's got to be shared with everybody, because not everybody's going to necessarily pick this piece up and do this work. And, you know, culturally, the belief is that each youth carries a gift and that they just have to find that gift. And that brings them that, you know, that purpose, that contribution. And for some people, you never know where, you know, these seeds land, these seeds or ideas land. So I think that going forward, seeing more Indigenous-led research within the field, but also just resurgence of knowledge and practice and of asserting boundaries as well, like in terms of how this knowledge is nurtured and built within community. Because I think, like we said, early ethnographies and ethnobotanical research, you know, has contributed greatly to people who would explain this knowledge of plants as being sleeping, you know, and it's a gentle way to refer to a really harsh and brutal time. You know, when I think about my grandparents or my great aunts and uncles' experiences with residential school, the fact that, you know, I tried to put myself in their shoes, and all I can come up with is, I don't know how I would have survived, you know, either attending or having my children stolen and forced to attend. And so when we think about futures and we think about healing and what that looks like from, you know, that perspective, I envision communities who have led that work, have picked up that knowledge that people have preserved through research and collected, but taking it in a direction of really application in terms of what that particular community envisions for being, you know, supportive of health and well-being from a cultural perspective. And then I would hope in the field that, you know, there's just a stronger move towards really that critical self-awareness that takes effort, takes energy, it takes time, and it takes discomfort, being able to sit in discomfort and sort of moving ourselves, you know, I say, like, collectively as academics, off this sort of pedestal of expert and really humbling yourself to learn. And I think from that place, the possibilities of really meaningful collaboration and impact in terms of how Indigenous communities define, you know, positive impact from research could be realized in the future and now, starting now too.
Yeah, like if you're a researcher and you're not putting in a big fat line item in your budget for youth, like, don't even bother, right? Like, get just go home now. Don't bother.
Totally.
Well, Lee, it's a pleasure as always. I admire your work. I've admired your work for so long. I, you know, technically we're academic cousins, so that's always cool. And I'm so glad you're now at SFU right down the hall. We'll have to keep scheming and thinking of ways to do this critical work together. And definitely. Just congrats on all your amazing work.
Hey, Chika, thanks so much. It's so nice to sit with you and just have these conversations. It really helps remind me just also of kind of the foundation that I'm working from, all while celebrating the beauty of plants. Fidelity.